Blog Talk Radio.
This road leads to Rainbowville. Going my way, up ahead is Bluebird Hill. Going my way, just pack a basket full of wishes, and off you start with Sunday morning in your heart. Round the bend, you'll see a sign, Dreamer's Highway. Happiness is down the line, going my way. The smiles you gather will look well on you. Oh, I hope you're going my way.
Welcome to Stage Left. It's a Fire Talk production. Our guest is Michael Clemminger, author of Everybody Knew, formerly known as Holy Terrors. It is my deep honor to give the stage to one of the bravest men I know. Michael, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
How are you? I'm so excited to have you on the show, and I'm looking forward to hearing every word you have to say.
Thank you very much.
Before we get started, can you tell everyone where to purchase your book?
I'm not quite sure yet because the details have only just come through to me, and I'm not quite sure of what's happening. All I know is that the book has been released on the 19th of January, and it can be got in Ireland.
And that publishing company website, though, I believe
Ebury.
Is www.ebury.co.uk, and you should be able to purchase this book there as well.
Thank you. Saying that Crosby song is bringing back so many memories to me over the years. I haven't heard it in a good while. In all the years I was in that school, it was probably the only escape I ever had out of it. I used to, when he'd come on the radio, I used to just float into a different world away from the misery of the place. He was a great part of my life when I was a young boy.
Yeah, I could definitely see how that song can take you when you're in such a horrible place. To a world that feels safe for a moment. So I'm happy you had that.
It was a price I had to pay for one of the brothers that was one of my abusers. He had a great love of Crosby. And I asked him about him one day, and he gave me his life story in the book and used to got films into the school for me because I liked him. And they used to let me sit up on Saturday night at 7:30 to 9 o'clock to watch his films on the television when he was playing the priest. And that's where I got my desire to be a priest from, I suppose, in some ways.
So I was hoping you would be able to share some of your book with us. Is that something you're able to do?
Yes, I think so, yeah.
All right.
Maybe if I could contextualize the book at the time.
Yeah.
The book was written about a period in the 1950s in Ireland, which was dominated by the church in every aspect. And sex was not a subject that was discussed. So if any young girls got pregnant, it was frowned upon, and all them children, a lot of them were taken away and put into orphanages. And I was one of those boys. So that's the context in which I came to be in this place. My mother wasn't married, and the parish priest took me from the home once I was born, because they didn't want the neighbours talking about an illegitimate bastard child running around with our children, other neighbours' children, and that was the context in which I came to be in this institution. And there were many more like me at that time.
Absolutely. Thank you for clarifying that. Do you want to go ahead and pick a passage to begin, and then we'll just kind of journey through this all together?
Well, probably the book is essentially about St. Joseph's Industrial School. So once I was born, I was put into with the nuns. But when I was 8 years of age, they no longer kept me. So maybe I could start there and talk about the first time I ever saw a Christian brother and read something about that. We were assembled in the refectory after breakfast and told that the Reverend Mother wanted to talk to each of us individually. By the time it was my turn to be brought into her office, I had watched a stream of boys coming out crying in great distress. Gazing coldly at me, the Reverend Mother informed me that because I had no parents and was an orphan, I was to be transferred forthwith to St. Joseph's Industrial School in Tralee in County Kerry. And that is essentially how I got told that I was going down there. And a little while later then, these two men walked up towards me, and we were all assembled in the yard. 24 of us were picked to go to St. Joseph's. One of the brothers, the lead brother, introduced himself as a Brother Price, telling us that we were to call him Sir at all times. He was a big man with piercing eyes who was obviously used to giving orders and having them obeyed instantly. Passing up and down the roads with two boys, he peered at us quite menacing fashion. If it was his intention to frighten and instill the fear of God in all assembled, he achieved his goal. When he passed me, I diverted my eyes towards my shoes. After a few words with the Reverend Mother, he approached me and asked my name. Michael Clemenger, I replied nervously, without looking up at him. Very well, Michael. I am Brother Price. Can you repeat it for me, Michael? Brother Price, sir. With that, he touched my face with his finger and half smiled as I recoiled from him. I was filled with fear and felt distinctly uncomfortable, especially that he had not asked any other boy a single question. And from that moment on, I was to learn subsequently that by placing his hand on my face, he had picked me out to be his special boy. I didn't know the significance till I went to St. Joseph's. And he was one of my main abusers for till 1966. And all the way down to Kerry, he kept me on his lap and held me very tight to himself, caressing me and touching me in ways that I'd never experienced. Nobody had ever touched me like that before, not the nuns, only in beatings. But nobody had ever had any physical contact with me in that sense. And I was terrified. It was one of the worst change journeys I ever had in my life. But a lot more was to happen there afterwards. So there.
I can't even imagine to be on a train and be so disoriented and to go right in the hands of a predator.
Yeah, he flaunted it. He made no attempt to hide his affections. It was an extraordinary, almost overwhelming situation to find myself in, because I'd never experienced any physicality ever prior to that by anybody.
You probably wouldn't even hardly seen any.
I'd never seen it. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what his intentions were. All I know that I felt very uncomfortable, and he was extremely powerful, and I couldn't get out of his hole. Even to go to the toilet, he wouldn't allow me to do.
Wow.
So for the 4 hours down on the train journey, all the boys ran up and down the train in the great excitement, and the other brother just looked at us, and he didn't say anything, you know. So, anyway, when we got into Tralee, anyway, we went into the main refectory, and I was met by another brother who did exactly the same, but he was more senior. So within the space of a few hours, two Christian brothers that were to be pivotal in my life made sexual advances towards me in the company of each other and were vying for my emotions and approval and smile and all that. It's a very, very difficult thing for a young boy 8 years of age to understand. I'd never experienced anything like it. So I was completely confused. I was quite angry, really, that I should be in that situation, because I didn't know what was happening.
Absolutely. I don't even know what kind of skill that a child would even have to be able to comprehend two predators. It's bad enough for one predator, but to have two that openly know each other?
Yeah, they knew each other, and I was to learn subsequently that each of them had their own harems, as they call it, a stable of boys. that they interfered with. But once I came on the scene, professionally, Brother Roberts in particular, the older man, became monogamous. He had no interest in any other boys, only me, and he made it his business that I was to become his favorite boy. And over the next 8 years, he satisfied all his sexual fantasies with a virgin child and did all kind of unspeakable things. I hope your audience is not offended.
No, we're not offended at all. We're offended that you had to live that. That's the only thing we're offended by, but we're never offended by you speaking your truth.
Well, I'm aware of people's sensibilities, because in Ireland, since my book has come out, people have recoiled from me in extraordinary ways, you know, which I would never have expected. People look upon me as a very peculiar kind of guy, you know, that has lived a life for the last 40 or 50 years that they never knew about, that I had reinvented myself to survive in society, and they look upon me now as some kind of a shady character that has a secret past. And since the book has come out, I have lost a lot of friends. Well, it's a relative term, friends, but
yeah.
People have recoiled from me, and people are wary of me in ways that I never expected. It's almost like being brutalized all over again, if you understand.
I understand completely.
And I'm taken aback by it.
Anyone that even looks at you crossways for speaking your truth is the ones who are completely in the wrong, because you are just a child, a victim of their system that they created and that they continue to fund. So they have no right whatsoever to even begin to question you. They should be looking at themselves and allowing a society that can just take children at random and play with them as if they're nothing. That's a reflection of all of us, not a reflection of you.
Yeah, one of them even asked me, you know, did I embellish the book to sell it?
Oh,
did I make up the stories? And that I found extremely offensive, particularly when he was an ex-priest himself.
They're always so quick to judge the victims, but
never want to
point the finger at the people who actually created the whole system and run it and made money off of children. Yeah. And so I'm thankful that you did write the book. And
well, I wrote the book with thinking it might be a catharsis process, but I think that I'm more disillusioned and more bitter now than I ever was all the years since I left St. Joseph's, because I have been angered by the attitude of people in general and the church in particular. You know, they feel offended that this type of information should come out, because they expected people like me to disappear into whiskey bottles and never reappear again.
Right.
And just be non-members of society. But I was not prepared to give it up. And I always fought for myself, and I always believed that I would make it.
And you will make it.
I have made it. I always
believed
that I have made it.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm 60 years old now, and I will never be over it, but it doesn't own me.
And the fact that you had to fight your whole life for something that should have never existed is an outrage.
It is an outrage.
It's not a reflection of you at all, Michael. It's a reflection of us and society. But it never was about who you were as a human being. And anyone who judges you, they're not seeing you. They're seeing their own projection of what the church told them to believe.
Well, but the church is still very powerful in this country. You know, the lay clergy is the greatest threat to people. Lay clergy, these are these Catholics who hug the altar rails every day at Mass. And,
right.
You know, and join the Legion of Mary and do all these good works. But their hearts are made of granite. They don't want any criticism of the church. They're hypersensitive to the church criticism. And there's a lot of them around the place.
Because they get their identity from the church, from what they do in the church.
And it would appear that that's the case, yeah.
Right. So they're invested in the church staying and running, no matter what price the children have to pay for it. And there'll come a time in their life where they'll have to pay for those concepts.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
But I'd like to get to talk to you a little bit about the manipulative way they went about their business and the secretiveness of it all. The brothers knew, all the brothers, there was 12 brothers in that school, and every one of them knew that sexual abuse of children was going on. There was only 3 or 4 active, but the rest knew and said nothing. And I always condemned them. because they didn't do anything. Even
Absolutely.
The superior knew. And, you know, it was basically, in my life, there was only the two men, sexual predators, sexually active. And then the other two were Brother Murphy and Brother Lane, were the sexual sadists. They didn't take their sexual gratification out in terms of penetrating wise. They liked to beat us with straps and bamboo shoots into our anuses and things like that. They got the pleasure from that. They were not able to perform sexually in the sense the other two were. And they were quite sadistic. And they were the four people, really, in essence, who ran the institution in the time I was in it.
And these were Christian brothers, right?
They were all Christian brothers, yeah. Yeah.
So there was nothing in place whatsoever to stop the sociopathic behavior of these people.
Well, I think when I look back on it, their view was... We had 300, there was 300 of us boys. There were 12 brothers, four brothers really that ran the school, so four against 300. The imposition of an iron will was the only way they could control us. So they brutalized us and starved us.
You know, I'm going to have to correct you on that with no disrespect, but
yeah,
what you're mentioning and what they did to you is far beyond any parental discipline to keep order. That is just pure sadistic pleasure because they could, because they had the power to be able to do it. It wasn't because of the structure. It was just they were twisted, they knew children were vulnerable, and that's why they came to those kind of positions.
I think that's a fair point. I think that's a fair point.
All right.
But from morning to night, you never knew at what stage or at what time you would be beaten or what time you'd be sexually abused. It was an ongoing process. But I, in my particular case, once I was picked out, my position in the school changed completely. Once Brother Price and Brother Roberts put their hand on me, that meant I was off base for everybody else. No other boy or other brother could do anything with me because I was their prize. And that had its own costs because I was advanced in the school into various good jobs, like a school chaplain, go down to town to meet the people every day, get the newspaper. So I had a special position to go across to the nuns to serve the mass. So I was a special boy. Everybody knew who I was. In and around the town, over in the convent, in the sweet shops when I went downtown, everybody knew this man. I was known as a monastery boy, or a mono boy. So it had its rewards being their special pets, as they called, as I was
right.
called. But the cost was extremely high. And I got extra food as well, which only added to my sense of guilt knowing the other boys were hungry in the school, and there was not a lot I could do about it. So they had me in every way. Psychological warfare went on all the time with them because I never knew at what stage I would have to service them for the rewards that they would give me.
And it seemed like in the book, even like they were actually your safety, and it's like what insane world is this that the predator is your only safety from being beat by other people or the children themselves who turn, I mean, to go in the schoolyard was a life and death thing. And it's like there was no control over that. I mean, they would just turn and just eat you alive. So
yeah, but once I had Brother Roberts on my side, that was the really plus for me because it meant that even Price's movement on me was restricted somewhat because he was the deputy head of school. So he had the rights because of his seniority, and he exercised those rights over me very, very carefully, almost like a father, like a mother, perversely. And he made sure that nothing happened to me when he was about. But he wasn't always there.
So how did he get introduced into...
Basically, Brother Roberts... He was in charge of the chapel. And in April 1960, he stopped me from going down to supper one evening, and he called me. Will I read a little bit for you?
Yeah, please do.
Okay. The relationship between Brother Price and Brother Roberts, whatever it was prior to my arrival in St. Joseph's, steadily declined into intestine warfare. They vied openly for my affections and attention. I bitterly resented being put in such a bewildering position, not knowing which way to turn. What did they see in me? I was quite small for my age. Fair hair with greyish blue eyes. I was always quick to smile and combined an inquiring mind with perhaps just the right amount of shyness. Most of the time I stared at the ground until I was spoken to, but once addressed, I was articulate and afraid to ask the questions. When I was about 9 years old, Brother Robert stopped me one evening as I was leaving the chapel after saying the rosary. "Michael Clemenger, I want a word with you, son." The other boys raced past me on their way to the refectory. "Don't worry about missing supper, Michael. I have arranged it with Brother Lane. Come along, I have something special to show you." He brought me into the closet where the soutanes were stored and picked out a long black one, gown and white vest to go with it. "Now, Michael, let's go to my room." Nervously, I followed him into the private residence of the Christian Brothers, down a long corridor with one window that looked directly into the senior dormitory. The lights were on, allowing me to spot a solitary boy on one of the beds. Brother Roberts pointed out the individual rooms of the brothers, which were dimly lit. We passed the bathroom, prompting him to ask me if I wanted to use the toilet. "No, sir." In truth, I was somewhat between terrified and bewildered at finding myself in such close proximity to the private lives of the brothers. When we arrived at his room, which was almost the farthest end from the chapel, he pulled out a set of keys and opened the door. "In you go, Michael." I distinctly heard Brother Murphy praying aloud in the room next door. "Oh, don't mind him. He's always that sort of thing, Michael. You'll get used to it in time." Locking the door behind us, he told me to get undressed. Bewildered, I removed my clothes until I was standing naked, shivering and completely unsure of what was expected of me. He sat on the only chair, which was beside the bed. "Get into the bed, Michael, if you're cold." Glad to cover my nakedness, I jumped into the bed. It was much softer than my own. It had lovely white sheets, two pillows and a couple of heavy blankets. On the wall ahead was a picture of the Sacred Heart and the crucifix. Books were scattered on a nearby table. Black hats hung from that handstand and a black brolly stood beside the door. The room was very cozy. Despite this, however, I felt ill at ease. There was something not quite right about the way Brother Roberts had stared at my body. "Would you like to be an altar boy, Michael?" I nodded fearfully. "Well, so you shall." He pulled back the bedclothes and began stroking my arms and chest. His hands were trembling, but warm. Leaning over me, he kissed me on my shoulders, neck, and even my ears. Frozen, I kept my eyes on the crucifix opposite me. It struck me that Jesus was almost naked on the cross. I had never noticed it before then. Heavy grunting and mourning brought me back to the appalling reality. Brother Robert's lips crushed against mine, sucking them as if he was eating a ripe orange. I could hardly breathe. In panic, I tried to push him away, but he was too strong for me. I was utterly terrified and actually thought that I might die. Such was the suddenness and ferocity of his attack. After maybe 10 minutes, it was all over. He quieted down and his breathing returned to normal. I sat upright in the bed. "Stand out on the floor, Michael, and try on the black soutane." Meekly, I did what I was told and put on the robe with his help. Gently combed my hair with a brown brush and stroked the back of my neck with his hands. "Look in the mirror, Michael. Do you see how beautiful you look? My, you'll make a fine altar boy." Opening a drawer, he took out a bag of sweets and said I could start eating right away. I was also presented with a sweet drink, yellow in colour, and told to sit on the bed. "You're going to be my top altar boy, Michael. Would you like that?" What could I do but nod my head helplessly? "Promise me, Michael, you'll say nothing of this to the other boys. Some of them might get jealous and try to hurt you. You're going to be my favorite boy, which means I'll always take care of you. Just wait and see. Get dressed now and leave the soutane on the chair, and I'll take you down to the kitchen for your own special supper. In this brother's kitchen, a tray bearing my name sat proudly on a table covered with tea towel. Go on, Michael. Look at what's underneath the towel. It's your reward for being such a good boy. At this point, I was feeling rather overwhelmed by the whole episode and found it hard to take in what had just happened. There was a knock on the door, on the kitchen door. Brother Roberts answered it, and whoever it was went away. Do you like buns, Michael? Yes, sir. I couldn't understand why I was being rewarded, as I hadn't done anything. Remember, Michael, you mustn't tell anybody what went on in my room. It will be our little secret. And so it started. 6 to 8 years of this. Even to the very last day that I left the place. That was my introduction to the brutality of... He was a different man when he was sexually aroused than when he was a normal. You know, and he was a very likable man in some respects, but not when he was sexually excited. He was a stranger to me. I didn't know him at all. I was very frightened of him. And he never treated me with any kindness during that sexual episode. It was just the gratification of his desires. He was a very evil man.
And what they do, too, is they starve the children and deprive them of just basic human interaction, to where children are so starved for affection that they will do anything to get acceptance or find any place where they feel like they have any power.
Funny enough, I never understood the concept of affection or love or like or anything.
To get approval was
essentially all it was, because it meant you got other things, the other privileges came with it. But I wasn't to be aware of that to the extent of later on, you know.
Everything they did, they had a motive.
I think he really, in a perverse way, I think he really loved me in that sense. Not like a son, but like a lover. You know, I know it's...
Yes.
He felt that. He felt great affection for me, and he showed it everywhere and anywhere. He saw me in public, or he'd be coming and going around the place. He would always make a beeline to me and show his affection. And he would kiss me full on the lips in the playground in front of other boys. It was most strange.
Really?
Yeah, he was most out of control when he would see me. I would just get him going, I don't know what I ever did. But he would.
It's not a matter of what you did. Seems like these predators, just the thought of, I mean, just seeing a boy, a young boy, it does something to them, like, that is sexually different. I don't know exactly, you've witnessed it way more than I have.
Well, he was very tactile towards me, and he said I had the most beautiful skin that he'd ever seen in a little boy. And that was one of the things I always remembered about him, you know. And when he said to me shortly afterwards that we will have a weekly bath so that I can keep your skin pure and holy and keep it clean. And that led on to the ritual Wednesday baths every Wednesday for the rest of my time in there. And they were horrific affairs.
Jeez.
Because as I got older, he wanted to have, in a sense, anal sex. And he was upset that his penis couldn't enter my anal area. And that really upset him in many ways. So he was much more brutal in his sexual encounters there afterwards. Always hoping that he could penetrate me, but he never was able. Which is the strangest thing of all when I think back on it. But apart from his sexual encounters, he was a very affectionate, kind man to me. And that's why I have ambivalent feelings towards him.
Well,
it's like Stockholm syndrome.
Well, it's kind of a skewed perception. When you're in an environment devoid of any compassion, even the smallest compassion seems grand. Does that make sense?
It does make sense.
Normally in a regular environment, his compassion would be probably not even something that would make your radar. But because they create such an environment that is so lacking of humanity, that even the slightest kindness, even if it's wrapped in sexual expectations, is still better than what exists without it, if that makes any
sense.
I
wouldn't have survived that place without him, because I would have been, I'd have been crucified by other boys. The other boys would pass me and leer at me. It was just one of those things. I don't know if you've ever seen a photograph of me, photograph me emerged, that I was a very attractive young child. And I can understand why, looking back over the years, why they would have picked me up, because there was a lot of what they referred to as ugly boys.
Well, you mentioned, too, that they had like a harem, a boy, but once you came along, so those boys were still there,
and they
lost all their privileges.
Yes,
so that made
true.
You a huge target.
Yeah, but he made sure, he obviously understood that, because he made sure I had the protection.
Right.
From the other boys. The only incident that ever occurred was one of the other boys, was when he was on holidays, and Price got to hear about it, and he went berserk, and he crucified that young lad.
What?
He raped me. He tried to rape me. He tried to penetrate me, that young boy. He was about 14 or 15, and he was severely dealt with. But they were not on the scene at the time to protect me. They were under summer holidays, which was usually during August. They come back in September. And Price in particular called me back to inspect me and make sure my body was fine. He saw all these black marks and everything. And he said, "The name of the boy, please, Michael." And he crucified him. So they were very protective of me, but it had a tremendous cost. And I think I look back now and I see that. But I didn't see it then.
Well, you had, reading the book, the greatest survival skills I've ever seen a human being of any age have, where you knew how to work those brothers and play them against each other and find protection within that. At such a young age.
I did it consciously.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you how I did it. Because when I was brought up to be in charge of Father Lee's room, I don't know why, I went to visit the various rooms of these brothers. And I got the personalities from the layout of the rooms, particularly now, brother. I knew each brother's personality by virtue of the room. How I did that, I don't know. I can't understand it. But I was able to measure the men, each of them in turn, on the basis of what the rooms looked like, which is a very strange. I'm sure psychologists have great fun with that. But I used that information.
Absolutely.
To survive, and I used it deliberately. And I played one off against the other all of the time. It was the only way to survive. I had to do it.
And you knew where they got their power from. You knew their weaknesses, all of it.
I knew their vanities. And that was
their vanities. And you used their vanities against them.
I think it's a strange thing, but it was inbuilt, because I wasn't aware of it at the time it was happening. It was only subsequent when I left the place that I realized what the game I played. And it was a very dangerous game, because
it was.
If they were aware that I was playing one against the other.
Oh, yeah, you could have been killed, but then your whole life, you could have been killed at any moment, and nobody would have even thought twice about it.
I don't know if I ever told you the story. It's in the book. It's the story of Joseph Pike. Joseph Pike was a boy who came to St. Joseph's from my place in Dublin in 1941, and he was killed in the school. And when I went there, there was a photograph of him hanging on the wall just in the playground. And I don't know, I had a strange attraction towards this boy. His eyes could penetrate towards mine. And he held me always in his look. He was such a fine, strapping young lad. And I often asked about what happened to him. And the boys told me, "Don't ever cross Brother Lane, the weed, as we call him, because you could end up like Joseph Pike on the wall." And for all the years I was in it, I never passed his photograph a day without thinking that I could die at any moment. I always felt that I would die there, because this brother, the weed, Brother Murphy, or Lane, took a tremendous dislike to me, because I was so much a pet with the others. So he sought out opportunities to destroy me, you know, but he couldn't do anything, because Price was a younger, much more virile man, and he said if anything happened to Michael Clemenger, he would never hit another boy again in the school. But I always thought I would die there.
And you would have if you didn't have the survival skills that you had.
It's likely I would have died there, because I had a tremendous affinity with this young lad, and he never left my mind, even 50 years on. I still see his picture on the wall. It's
You wrote something for him, didn't you?
I did. I wrote a poem for Joseph.
Would you share that with us?
I'll read a few lines of it out for you now, yeah. But he was only 16 years of age, and he was killed by brother. Maybe I'll give you the circumstances.
Okay.
He was in charge of a table. Each table had 12 people on it, 12 boys on it. And his job was to make sure after the dinner that there was no potatoes left with a bit of spud that you could eat in it. And on this particular day, the spuds were so bad and rotten that he didn't bother checking them because he thought there wouldn't be anything. And he stood up anyway and up to Lane, who was sitting up at the top on his high chair, and he just looked through it. And he saw the piece of potato. And he went into a quiet rage, but he didn't say anything for a moment. And then, all of a sudden, when Joseph wasn't looking, he just kicked him in the chest. And he went down. And he never regained consciousness. And he died a couple of weeks later in the local county hospital.
Jesus.
And nobody could believe it. And he got away with the murder. So when I was writing the book, I went down to visit his grave in Tralee. And this is the poem I wrote him. I call it, "You Were Not Destined to Grow Old." I pass your picture on the wall. Your eyes that showed promise. Your jaw bestowed with firmness. And yet your flowering was cut down by a weed. Uncalled for brutality took you and instilled in me a fear of the dark. You had no time to say goodbye. I had no time to weep. You lie forever young in the cold clay. I sit a while beside your grave and ponder the possibilities. 50 years have since gone by. I still see your picture on the wall. You are caught forever young, full of promise. I don't think you would mind at all. Full turn the circle of time. Sleep well, friend, away from the crown of thorns. I never got to say hello, but I honor you in saying goodbye. Old age would not have suited you with all its pains and disappointments. Sleep well, comrade, on the wall. You were too good a flower, struck down by weed. I wrote that poem 10 minutes beside his grave. It's almost as if he was speaking to me. I still see his picture now, and I'm 60 years old. And I feel guilty that I'm not in there with him. I should have been.
Why did you not
Christ and Roberts, I wouldn't have survived. Because he very nearly killed me. He wanted to kill me. He was such a violent man.
And yet you confronted him, right?
I confronted him, yeah.
And that, to me, was the moment that I'm like, this little fella is the bravest soul I've ever seen. There was something within you that was bigger than whatever system that they could create or try to put you in. You just saw them so for who they were. But can you tell the story of when you confronted this man who had already killed a child, right?
Yeah, basically what happened was that he never liked anybody to look up at him. He hated eye contact with boys. Such was his distaste of us boys that if you looked at him without his permission, you get a severe beating. And that was the way he was. So nobody looked up at him. They always looked out of the corner of the eye, and they would hiss around the place the murderer was about. So one particular Saturday morning, just out of the blue, there was a lovely, happy song, Cliff Richard, on the radio, Summer Holiday, and it just turned around, and it caught his eye full on, and he went absolutely berserk. He jumped down off his seat, lifted me up in the air like a rag doll, and brought me down into the dungeon in the back of the kitchen. I wouldn't take my clothes off, and he said, I'd tell Brother Price about you. So you tell effing Price, I'll give you something to effing well tell him. So with that, he just ripped my clothes literally off me body, and told me to lie across the Tea Church was in the middle of the empty bare room. I took down two bamboo shoots, one in each hand, and horsewhipped me, and tried to stick the bamboo shoots up my ear, and he said, "I'll give you something to tell Price about." And I just fainted. The last thing I remember was I was wearing socks, which was a very strange thing to remember. And I was out cold, and the boys told me afterwards that he went back to his place as if nothing happened. And then when the breakfast was over, he told the boys to clean up the mess in the dungeon. That was it.
So you could have very easily died that day.
Well, the brothers wanted me, when they brought me to the bedroom, the doctor was called, such were the extent of my injuries. So, but they didn't, they wouldn't let me go to the hospital because they would have had to explain how I came across these injuries. But he was removed from the place afterwards on the basis of that, because Price had told him that there wasn't room in the place in the St. Joseph for the two of them, so he left.
Wow. Now, who did you challenge on this? Was it on
this? There was one other brother there. His name was Brother Murphy. He was a man overcome with religious piety. He was so religious that he thought even going to watch a picture in the any three or four boys to collect together in front of the television, if their hands met in front of them where you could see them, he thought they might be interfering with each other and masturbating, as you know, a term you...
Yeah.
You know, and he was a man that I personally didn't confront it deliberately, because I didn't. I thought he was a very cruel man. And he was... One night, his hurley went missing and he came in to say the rosary, and he asked us to say a special rosary that God in his infinite wisdom and mercy would return his hurley, and that he would spend 5 minutes with his eyes closed, and that he would pray silently, and in that time whoever took his hurley to bring it back and all would be forgiven. And we did this Indian chant, which we'd never seen, because everybody burst out laughing. And he opened an eye and he said, "Clemenger, I'll make an example of you," because we're sitting in the front. And with that, I stormed out. I said, "You're not going to beat me." And wait for... His problem was, he would wait for a month. So you knew for 30 days, you were going to get a beating. So you were terrified. You were bet every day because of the fear. So I confronted him on the spot. And he said, "So you want to take me on?" He says, "No." He beat the living daylights out of me and threw me down a load of steps and kicked the testicles out of me. And I woke up unconscious and was in bed, and the surgeon came, the doctor was called, and he said, "This young boy will have to be operated on because his testicles are all over the place." Well, they were talking about my testicles, and they refused. So I ended up losing one of them, and the other one was malfunctioned, so I never could have killed them.
So that moment right there determined whether you would have children or not.
Yeah, they determined it, because the thing could have been fixed. So I discussed it afterwards with physiology colleagues and doctor colleagues of mine over the years, that had it been done at the time, it could have been saved. But they let it go, and I got a hernia that would come up and down into the stomach and pop up and down when I'd cough. So I ended up having an orchidectomy, or the removal of the testicle organ, and the other one is somewhat problematic. Well, I'd probably end up losing that one as well eventually, but it meant I couldn't have no children.
That
was one of the great regrets I have in life.
Oh, my God. When you woke up, though, not only was it bad enough that one almost tried to kill you, but when you woke up...
Oh, yes, there was three Krishna brothers at the end of the bed, one each side.
You were surrounded by predators.
Yeah, the predators, and they were discussing which one of them would wash my penis, because they wanted me to be... The superior was just concerned whether I was clean in the front and back. So they were deciding between them which one of them had washed and which had dried. So, you know, I was there. It was the most strange thing. There's one thing I remember to this day, that, you know, the conversation between the three of them, and the Krishna, that superior, could see that there was something going on, but he didn't say anything. He said, "Whoever's doing it, get on with it." So the two of them decided that one had washed and one had dried based on seniority. And then Dr. Sullivan came in and he asked me what happened. And I could tell by their eyes that they didn't want me to say that I had been beaten. So I said, "I fell down the stairs." He said, "Do you see who pushed you?" And he said, "I don't believe..." I could see he didn't believe me. But I couldn't say anything because I was afraid. afraid of what would happen, and I had reason to, because it just didn't happen.
Right.
But the doctor never came back, and they just gave me tablets for a couple of days, and I spent a few weeks in bed, and that was it.
Yeah, of all the things to be concerned about when a child wakes up after being beaten, that is not the area that they need to
focused
on.
No, I found it
on.
A very strange situation to find myself
it
in.
It was like that they've been deprived of their favorite boy. And so they even within that moment, couldn't even demonstrate any self-control.
No. And they lingered longer than they should, each of them in turn, which was very strange.
Yeah, so it was weird. It was like the predators all...
They knew my lower body then as well as I knew myself, you know.
Yeah.
I found that very strange. And they looked at each other very, very nervously. And, you know, each knew the role of the other.
Yeah. And so you have actually three people that would openly do that, and all knowing that the other one is, you keep my secrets, I'll keep yours, kind
yeah.
of
yeah.
weird exactly. conversation. It must have been the most bizarre thing in the world.
I mean, you couldn't make it up. I mean, when I think back on it, when I was actually writing that piece, I was wondering whether I should leave that in or out, because I thought people might wonder, is that real? But that
no,
that,
I'm and the. The thing is when you have people like that, the child becomes such a possession that it becomes an extension of them. So
yeah,
anything you do to that child is an insult to the person. It's never about the child. It's always about, well, I can't believe you would touch something that belongs to me. Not that child is worthy within itself to not be touched.
Yeah.
But only because he's property of mine does he have value, which in itself is flawed.
They spend all of their time trying to outdo each other in terms of generosity.
Right. So it was one big pissing match is what it basically was.
You know, and to the very end, it was always one trying to outdo the other, and I
right.
in the middle. And I couldn't show affection for one or the other. And on one occasion, I smiled at Brother Roberts coming from Mass, and I got a severe beating from Brother Price. I was only 9 at the time. And because I looked at him, he says, oh, you look at Brother. And he just took me out, and he brought me into the bedroom, and he just stripped me naked and beat me. Now you look at Brother Roberts again, he says, you know about it. So this kind of thing went on. So I learned very early on to play the game at a very low key and in clever way, so that neither of them knew which one I preferred. You know, which is the title of the new book now that's coming out, because they took out that passage. I think it happened below in the graveyard. We had a graveyard attached to the school. And Brother Roberts would bring me down there occasionally. And we'd have long chats about, I can't even remember, but basically it was asking me what the other fella did. But I never revealed what one of the others said. And he asked me one day the question I always dreaded in my whole time there, which one of them I preferred. Because I didn't know if I said the wrong answer, would it get back to the other? And, but once... I told Roberts I preferred him, because I did really, because he was my main protector. He was like a silly schoolboy. He ran around the place doting on me for nearly 12 months. You know?
Yeah.
He knew I preferred him over Price. And Price knew that, so he had to try and get back and do something else. So he introduced this idea of Crosby and going to films at night, seeing all these things. So he was trying to get up. So between the two of them, I was the whole time being on my guard. I'm sure you understand what I mean.
Absolutely. And that's where I wonder about a child that, I mean, you had incredible survival skills and obviously are a highly intelligent person. But what about the child who isn't and didn't? What fate did they meet?
I feel that's my greatest sense of guilt that I have even now. That, you know, even when I went to Trinity and became an undergraduate in third level college, the first day I went there, I sat on the grass crying, because I felt, why me? Why did I survive? And so many equally as good lads didn't make it, you know. And I carry that guilt even now in my 60th year. I feel I should.
But the guilt isn't yours to carry.
But I have it. It's there. It's in my DNA. I can't unlock it and get rid of it. I feel even now guilty, because even last year when I was down in Kerry looking, when my book was launched, I saw people that I grew up with, I know completely. It was so sad, you know.
Broken.
Miserable, broken lives destroyed. Marriage is gone. Suicides. Alcoholism.
Right.
And yet I stand there in the midst of that chaos, almost like being transposed back into the school and being normal in that abnormality that was there. And for what purpose? I don't understand why I survived to write this book, and so many of them didn't, because some of them were as clever as me, if not more.
Well, maybe you survived to be their voice.
Well, I hope this book has done that to some degree, you know.
It definitely has done that. But the thing is, say you're in the middle of an ocean and you throw all the children off because some make it and some don't. It's not a reflection on the child. It's just some make it and some don't. When you have a system that is saturated with sociopaths and predators at the highest level that you can see in a human, and, you know, you're just a child. It's just that it's a reflection of us, Michael, that we allow a system to exist that could harm children and make you be put in a situation where you would ever even have to, as an adult, make those decisions. But as a child, to be able to make that is insane. It's just not possible.
I think my greatest disappointment probably in the school is the whole episodes of Father O'Neill. Father O'Neill was the local chaplain. He lived there. And I was in charge of his room every day. And he knew I was very bright from the get-go. And he would need tiny little bits of an egg at the top of a cup and a small little piece of toast occasionally to show approval of my good work, cleaning his room every day, you know. But he never spoke to me ever, ever, ever. Even when I'd be saying seven mass until my 16th birthday. Will I tell you that story?
Yeah.
Well, when I was 16 years old, the superior called me to his office, because once you were 16, you were usually thrown out of the place, give you some kind of job, and that was the end of it, you know. And he called me to Father O'Neill's room. So Father O'Neill knocked at the door and he told me to come in. And I was sitting over in the far corner. And maybe I should read some of it to you.
Yes, please.
But Father O'Neill had come back from the missions. So he spent his last days there. And he liked to have nothing to do with the boys, say, except to give confessions on a Saturday, which he hated doing, because there were so many of us. And his Sunday sermon on a Sunday, which was always about masturbation and sin and being an honest boy. I'll read this instance, which was to shape my life really for many years. I was 16 years old on the 1st of November 66. Brother Ryan called me to his office to inform me that I would be leaving St. Joseph's after Christmas. Go up to Father Lil's room at 4:30 this afternoon. He wants to have a talk with you. I thought this curious because the priest had little time for me. I knocked on his door at 4:30 sharp and left myself in at his bidding. Since he didn't invite me to sit down, I stood inside the door. He never looked up as he spoke. Tell me, young man, who are your parents? I was completely thrown by this question and told him that I knew very little about them. I only know what I hear from the Brother Price. He told me that my parents didn't wait until they were married before they had me, Father. He also said that I was baptized in neighboring parish, St. Nicholas of Moher and Francis Street in Dublin. Indeed, indeed, young man, do you know what that means? No, Father. Tell me, boy, why do the boys in the yards call you Father? Because they know I want to be a priest. Do you indeed? Yes, Father. Leaning forward in his chair and summoning up as much spiteful venom as he could muster, he took obvious delight and gave me the following piece of news. You, Clemenger, will never be a priest. Shall I tell you why? It's because you are a bastard, a product of sin. That's why. The term bastard was delivered with such a degree of disdain that I knew it had to be something bad. What does bastard mean, Father? It sounds like a bad word, is it? No, it's not a bad word in itself, but its meaning is a problem for you. And this is the reason that you will never be a priest. That's the holy all of the matter. So get these fanciful notions out of your head. It can never happen for you. You will never be a priest. His mission accomplished, he sat back in his chair. For months afterwards, I thought that this conversation was the most hurtful thing that I had ever experienced. It was much worse than the beatings from the brothers. My God, what a cruel man this priest was. I was only beginning to see him in his true colors. Without doubt, though he wore the collar, said the masses, heard the confessions, he long since lived up to the aspirations of his vocation. It wasn't so much his words that stung me, though to be sure I was heartbroken, but it was a shocking curt way in which he told me. I saw him as a man with broken ideals, who indulged his passions for food, wine, and spite, while awaiting the falling of the curtain on a life lived as a lie. His goal with me was to gloat over the misfortune of my birth and try to break down the dream that he once had. I felt his anger was directed at me because I probably reminded him of the simple humility, trust in the goodness of God that he may have had at once. Now, boy, get out of my sight and never let me hear any more of this foolishness. Close the door quietly on your way out. That was the most dreadful, dreadful thing in my life. If I was to sum it up in one incident, that was probably it. Because that label stuck with me and it had an awful effect. That the fact that I was unwanted, it clarified in a word the ugliness of my beginning. I knew then that I didn't belong to this world, that I should nearly have never been there. And it made sense to me then when Brother Lane used to say to me, "Don't be breathing the air of decent people, you little cur, you poison, you miserable little bastard." You know, terms like that, you know. And even now, I sometimes feel I should never have been here.
It's not you, Michael. It's them. It's the arrogance to think that they control God and somehow they can create a system.
He played God.
Huh?
He played God.
He played God is exactly right. He's not God. He has no power. They created this whole system as if they're the middleman to God, and they have nothing whatsoever to do with God. They have no power except their self-righteous creation of it. They can't tell you who you are. They can't tell you what you can be and who your God can be. They have no power to do that.
Well, my world stopped that day. You know, that was the end of my world, really. I didn't want to be in the world anymore. So I knew in the back of my mind that someday I would destroy myself. I knew that. And I very nearly did.
And any human being that would ever take a dream of a child, no matter what it is, and rip it to shreds and throw it on the floor and stomp on it, is the most sadistic bastard that exists. Actually, he's the bastard for doing that. I mean...
But it had a profound effect upon me. That.
I know. I remember that in the book, and I remember thinking that it was the cruelest damn thing I'd ever seen a person do, to do that to a child.
But he did it with such a certain delight.
Oh, yeah, because he was pure. The problem is these systems allow for sociopaths to become the leaders. And when they do that and they're allowed freedom to rip the children's dreams and hopes and soul to shreds with no mercy, then the system itself is what's creating that. It has no reflection whatsoever on who you are. The notion that a child is valid or invalid based on some legal document is a completely false notion to begin with.
I've never got, even now in my 60th year, I've never got over that.
I don't blame you. That is.
That has shaped me, because that situation was reinforced within a few years when I left the place and went away and got an interview for medicine. The same thing happened to me. Remember that incident?
Yes, I do.
Well, you know, when he asked me, I had the marks and I was called for interview, and he said to me, "Who's your father?" Well, I couldn't lie. I said, "I don't know." He said, come. And he asked me why I wanted to be a doctor. He said to me, "You know, I want to help people." He said, "Well, you can do that being a bus conductor." So he more or less told me, and then he pushed my papers aside, and he said to me, "Young man," he said, You were born on the wrong side of your tracks. Don't aspire above your station in life.
Ugh.
This kind of nonsense. But these two incidents stand out in my life and have shaped me to what I am today. And that's why I'm an outsider in this world.
I feel it. And that's why we need to bring you into our network. We're all outsiders. And we're gathering all the outsiders because the system itself is the illusion.
It's an illusion.
It's an illusion. None of it is true. None of their points are valid. They have no power to get anybody to heaven. None of that. They have no power to determine who you are as a human being when they lack a soul.
But I can assure you that I can assure you in the Ireland of that time.
Oh, I know.
When I left the school, I left at a label I'm honored by, and everybody in town, in the town of Tralee in County Kerry, they all knew Monoboys were lazy, dirty, troublesome, uneducated, uncouth, and they didn't want any of their daughters having anything to do with the likes of me. So most of us left to go to England. And most of them, probably of my groups at that time, are in England, if not dead. So you had to leave the country to gain identity.
Right,
but
there was no place for you to go to once, and they just threw you out on the street. What did they think you were going to do? You had no life skills. You had no interaction with the community. What were you supposed to do?
They sent me to a local hotel, and I was supposed to become a kitchen porter.
Which meant that they created domestic labor, manual labor.
I wasn't expected, I wasn't expected to rise above my station.
But that's the way they create those
stations.
That's
the way they operated,
And they,
we were uneducated and uncouth, and we were considered to be, we had a label of monobuys. Monobuys were undesirables, and most of them had to leave the country. But I wouldn't leave. I brazened it out, and I set out to show them all. And when I was leaving in 67, I was full of bitterness and rage. And when I was brought to the superior's office and told it's time to go, I decided that I would make one last call. The father in his room.
What'd you do?
I'll read that a little bit for you. But that was the most wonderful day.
Oh, I bet it was.
10th of January 1967. My best boy, my most beautiful boy. What am I going to do without you, Michael? I had no answer for Brother Roberts. By this stage, in spite of his interfering with me, I felt more sorrow for him than anything else. After all, he had made things relatively easy for me and had never once discouraged me in my dreams of becoming a priest. By the end, he was a sickly man, much less vigorous and vibrant when I had first met him. Still, he tenaciously stood for me when Father Neil complained about my walk. It was he who came to the yard to tell me to collect my things, but not before one last visit to the sweet shop. There he brought me a mixture of sweets, shoved his tongue down my throat for one last time while trying to maintain his composure. I had never seen him crying before. Go now to the dormitory and collect your things. I passed by the remaining boys playing in the yard. We just looked at each other, but no goodbyes were said. I walked to the junior dormitory, recalling my fearful first night there. The beds were all empty now. I wondered what had happened to the occupants there. Had they survived the big bad world outside? In the middle dormitory, old shoes lay abandoned on the beds no longer in use. Dust could be seen rising from the floor in the hazy sunlight. There was no hint of the back-breaking walk that had been performed for years to keep that place clean and tidy. The only residents these days were the spiders who slept in the cobwebs. In the senior dormitory, the only one still in use, I thought about all the crying and beatings that had taken place there. Finally came to my own bed. It had been my dream factory for 5 years. How often had I lain there racked with pain from the various beatings? How often had I been taken from here to fulfill the sexual fantasies for those who should have known better? Hung opposite my bed in the splendid isolation was the huge framed portrait of St. Dominic Savio. I had spent hours gazing at this picture, trying to make a connection with the saint. As far as I was concerned, he had unsympathetic eyes that burned right through me, especially if I had bad thoughts or dared to engage in sinful acts under the blankets when the hormones ran wild. Gathering my few belongings, I threw them into a small case, and with one last look at the room, I left by the sliding door. I went into the chapel. There was nobody there, so I made my way to the altar, invigorated by my anger that emanated from within. Basically, I thought this is where the seeds of my vocation were first sown. Would Jesus, who was supposedly living in the tabernacle, be able to measure the depth of my anger and react by striking me dead? By now, I had enough of this supposedly loving Jesus, Son of God, and his fairy tale of suffering the little children to come unto him. Lucky he kept himself hidden, otherwise he would have got a mouthful of abuse from me. I never gave our Blessed Lady a second look. Boy, I thought, what a fool I had been to think that either of them would ever love me, whatever that meant. However, I couldn't leave without venting my full anger at someone, and who better than that self-righteous, condescending grossness that lay in his bed nursing his various ailments. I decided to pay him one last visit. Along the corridor, I passed the empty rooms of Brothers Breen, Price, Bourke Lane, and Murphy. So many memories hurled themselves at me with such violence that they only fueled my rage. I dispensed with knocking politely on the priest's room. Instead, I burst in unannounced. What is the meaning of this outrage, the impertinence of this behavior, Clemenger? Shut your mouth. This bastard is here to tell you that he's leaving the school in a few minutes. I just wanted to tell you first that I think you're a lousy priest. He seemed unable to rise or respond, probably due to his shock, so I was free to continue my rant. Call yourself a priest? What did you do to stop the beatings and sexual abuse you knew that was happening in this place? He pretended not to know what I was talking about, which only increased my anger. Will you please leave my room, Clemenger, at once? Taking the end of the bed and slamming the door beside me, I told him that I would leave when I was ready. He took off his glasses, looking perplexed. Trapped by his ailing body, he could do nothing but repeat, please leave, please leave. I felt no pity. Shut up. This bastard would make a better priest 1,000 times over than you ever will be. Why do you think Fies gave up telling you about the sexual abuse they suffered at the hands of the brothers? You don't know? Well, I'll tell you, because you report their words back to the brothers, and then the boys got extra vicious beatings for their trouble. Tell me, Father, what kind of a priest would do that? He looked like he was going to have a heart attack. Don't worry, I'm going now, but I won't forget you or the brothers and what they've done to innocent boys in this place. While he appeared relieved to me that I was gone, I could see that I had hit home and had confronted him at least with what he knew to be true. I hoped that the echo of my words would sound in his ears for the rest of his days, reminding him of his part in the sexual abuse of children. To paraphrase Jesus, the little children that suffered had come to him where they had been accused of lying. This priest's inaction had been given the green light to those brothers who were free to indulge their sexual desires with us. I kicked the end of the bed and slammed the wardrobe door once more before I marched out of that room forever.
Wow. You are amazing. Amazing man.
I enjoyed that day.
Oh, I bet you did. And then that's the thing that I think you may not quite realize, that you have been fighting for those other kids as much as you could. But you were surrounded by predators yourself, so it was, you had to survive too. But you fought.
I was very conscious of the fact that, I often, in the reverse way, I remember one or two occasions when I saw other boys being, eyed on. I put myself forward on two occasions that I can recall to save a boy, one particular young lad, from being abused. I was aware that I could do that and had the power to do that.
So you took it yourself?
I was prepared to do it. I did it a couple of times because I knew I could endure it. I had endured so much.
And you almost got beat to death for taking up for someone as well. So that's
yeah,
why.
Yeah, why he abused me? Yeah, he would have been crucified. He was lay naked on the bed, with blood beating from his anus, his backside, and his back was all scarred with the leather with had trepanny bits at the top sewn into the thing, and he was beating him mercilessly. And he, there's no doubt about it, I thought he would kill him, you know, and I just stood between him, and he was taken aback that I was, why would you want to save this wretched? So I offered, you know, I was conscious that I had to do these little things, you know, but I didn't do them out of, I felt that I duty bound to do it, and I think I did that on some occasions, but it was very difficult.
Do you know, though, for you to maintain that level of humanity, being raised in a life where you were shown none?
I was surprised at that myself, yeah.
Yeah, it shows the spirit that you had to have when you came in this world, as that baby they're saying is nothing, it's worthless as a bastard, had to have the most enormous spirit and survival instincts of anything I've ever seen to be able to take what you took and to still come out as a compassionate human being. Because that's what they do. They kill your soul with this kind of stuff. And they didn't kill your soul.
No, that's why I went into the caring professions as I got older. I always felt that, you know, maybe I was compensating for my own guilt or whatever, because I went into this particular area when I was in nurse training, and I dealt with these types of individuals who have been abused. So in a way, I kind of eased it in for them, you know, in some sense, because I understood their pain. And I think,
and that's why I'm telling you, Michael, there is no guilt for you to carry. You put your life, your body, everything on the line over and over again to try to protect people. It's the system that you were in. There was no good way to do it. If there was, you would have figured it out. It's just, you were just a child, an amazing child, but just a child.
But I don't think it alleviates the guilt. I see that point, but there's guilt that I survived. I'm looking at a picture of about 14 of us here in the picture, and I know 9 of them whose lives have been wrecked. And I'm there standing out in that picture, and I feel terrible guilt, you know, that their lives, you know, they were only young lads like myself.
Exactly.
And we're all in that group. It's in one of the pictures in the book. I know that the lives of many of them were destroyed.
And that's what happens when you take a class of people and you make them your working class people. You don't educate them, and you beat the living hell out of them. Then you create that. You create suicide, you create alcoholism, you create all these different things. But it's a system that created that. And I am so beyond happy that you survived and that you found the courage to write this book. And your story is always going to be in my heart. And I will carry it no matter where I am, because you are a wonderful human being.
Thank you.
And I thank you deeply for sharing your story and having the courage you did to survive.
I hope your audience won't be too upset at some of the stuff that's in this.
There's absolutely no one that I'm worried about. If they're upset or not upset, they can just get over it. It's not even an issue. I am happy that I provided a space for you to be worry-free, that you can speak your truth without being washed down. And all I've asked and all I ever want from any survivor is for them just to speak their truth. And
that's one of the labels I'm happy with.
Yes.
I'm happy with that label because I know I've survived. But I hope the book in some way is a vindication of the spirit of some boys who just never got a chance to write it. It just
exactly.
Fell to me.
Exactly.
Okay then.
All right. And
God bless you.
Michael?
Yeah.
Bless you and your family, too.
God bless you all. Take care. Goodbye to your audience.
Bye,
all the best. Bye-bye to you. Love you. Bye now. Bye.
Bye.
This road leads to Rainbowville, going my way. Up ahead is Bluebird Hill. Going my way, just pack a basket full of wishes, and off you start with Sunday morning in your heart. Round the bend, you'll see a sign, Dreamer's Highway. Happiness is down the line, going my way. The smiles you gather will look well